we have an opportunity here to do something that is so important. And there's this extraordinary event that will happen in the life of every person here. We'll all die. And so this is a chance for us to explore what death means in our lives, what it means to be with those who are dying, and what it means to actually use death as the bedrock of our practice, the contemplation of death. This is Plato advised, and just as spiritual teachers for thousands of years have advised. Here we want to sit with this fact in a very matter-of-fact way. It's not to dramatize death, it's not to deny death, but it's simply to say, yes, this is inevitable. And in the light of this, what does my life mean at this moment? We have very few days together. Really, it's Wednesday evening. On Sunday, our community will expand to include everyone else, but not have the immediacy of this time of practice. I ask you to practice as if this is your last opportunity. And it could be. I will tell you one story. Henry and I are friends, and I like stories. So this is a story of a retreat I led in Canada on a small island at a place at that point is called Cold Mountain Institute. And there were 60 yogis there, and we were doing a very strict meditation retreat. And after the first period of Zazen, we got up to do Kinhin, walking meditation, and 59 people stood up, but one person didn't. This person was in the full lotus, and I had this sort of moment of irritation, like, why isn't he doing the schedule? And I saw him listing to the side. And I very slowly walked up to him, and he was dead. Gone. It was one of those moments. I've done many dangerous things in my life, and no one has perished so far in the course of them, but I was really rather surprised. And he just slowly went over, and his eyes were just empty. And as it happens, there were quite a large number of healthcare professionals in this retreat. Because I had done a training retreat 6 months before, and there probably were 15 or 20 physicians and nurses out of 60 people. And there was a big storm going on, so the Royal Mounted Police couldn't arrive in their helicopter. And we had this corpse in our midst. And so they had quite a good medical kit. That was really nice. So they could do, you know, the good things according to the medical, you know, necessities. But we got to do the good things too. And it was a young person, you know, maybe 40 years, well, young in my opinion, now that I'm 60. He was young, he was 40. He was just 40 years old, 38 or 40 years old. And he was gone. And then we found out, one of the physicians went to the hospital, his aorta had burst. And he died just like that. So I have always had this feeling of, oh, I really wish that it could be so easy for me. That was the rest of my prayer. That I could be so, have such good karma. Just a poof like that in the middle of a meditation retreat. But I don't want you to do it, okay? Not on my watch, I'm in this one. But it could happen. I mean, how many people last night went to bed? Sure, they would wake up in the morning, and they didn't. I mean, it's such a mystery. So let's live this retreat and our practice and in our interactions with the sense of immediacy. Really, as we go about our few days together, consider that every person here is mortal. But how does that change your relationship, one by one, moment by moment? Consider your own mortality. I mean, we don't know. Tomorrow you might not awaken from your sleep. Can you bring that sense of immediacy and presence into this moment right now? Now, all your cell phones are going to be put away. So we're just right here in the mandala of this practice. Can you practice as if this is your last day of life? Can you give your attention to this investigation instead of just taking it all for granted? When you sit, can you really appreciate this precious opportunity to sit together? When you walk, can you walk embodied and feel gratitude no matter what limitation exists within this body? It's hard to get one of these things, they say. Once every 100,000 years, a blind turtle surfaces in all the oceans of the world, and the likelihood of getting a human body is the likelihood of a blind turtle surfacing inside the embrace of a golden yolk. That's an old sort of Tibetan tale. So as we walk, there's a rose out front that just is extraordinary. Can you look at the flowers in the grasses with fresh eyes? Maybe I am, because I'm from the Southwest. Can you appreciate the life? No matter what limitation, what sonnet form your life happens to be in, how many syllables, how many breaths are left in this life? And what will be meaningful for you? Should you, as most of us dream, get to be an old person? You know, most of us have this idea, we're just going to, you know, kind of get white hair and then, well, should we get to be, you know, older? Do we have this thought about what's going to be important to us? Really? What really will make a difference now? At the end of our life. I sit with dying people a lot. They never talk about the number of cars they have or how many rooms are in their house. And the room of their life on one level is getting very intimate. They don't want so many rooms. You know, it's just not so interesting. And so the sort of big room becomes present as a possibility. So ask yourself, what will really bring you and others peace? Your death, your dying makes a difference in the lives of others. What will be meaningful at the end of your life? So what I would like us to do this evening is very simple. I know some of you have traveled far, and I'm grateful that you're here. I'd like to ask you some questions first, and then I want to give you some basic meditation instruction. It'll be very familiar to you, but it will be in the light of death. And then for us to enjoy a period of sitting, and then to go to bed. Then we'll see what happens tomorrow. So first of all, I'd like to ask, how many people here are involved in healthcare? Okay. How many physicians are here? Oh, now I'm just going to cry. That's just awful. Really, really bad. I only say that. Actually, in America, a lot of doctors now are getting on this. You know, we train a lot of physicians. Gosh, that really makes me sad. Tell your doctors to contemplate the inevitability of death. Are there any nurses here? Oh, good. One. Two. Oh, three. All right. Okay, that's interesting. Is there anyone here who has worked, currently works in a hospice as a volunteer or professional person? Oh, praise be. Good. Okay. Yeah, I have to tell you, in 1973, I came to England and spent some time the day Cecily Saunders at St. Christopher's Hospital. And she was very inspiring to me. The hospice movement is really important. How many of you are taking care of someone who is gravely ill? How many of you have lost a loved one in the past year? How many of you have never attended a death? How many of you have had or currently has a catastrophic illness? Well, you all do, actually. Sexually transmitted terminal condition, but nonetheless. Often those with a... Sorry. I do have a humor. That's very good to know. Often people who've been gravely ill have a more immediate sense of the value of what it means to face death. Mm-hmm. How many of you are pastoral people? Pastoral people, that's, you know, you do some kind of spiritual care, like you're a teacher or priest or pastor or spiritual counselor or something. Okay. How many of you consider yourself to be Buddhists? Mm-hmm. Here he is. Sorry. My only student here. Actually, it's my only student anywhere. How many of you have a Vipassana practice, a Theravadin practice? Mm-hmm. Zen practice? Mm-hmm. A Tibetan practice? Mm-hmm. An eclectic practice, sort of. All right, sort of the Ekayana. How many of you have a Christian contemplative practice? Okay. A contemplative practice in some other tradition. Who are the rest of you? I have to find out, but I did read the forms you filled out. Tomorrow I want to know a little more specifically why you're here, and we'll investigate that question. But I wanted to get a feeling for who's in the room. The basis of the practice of spiritual care or contemplative care, of course, is a meditation practice that brings certain qualities forward. It's not just one meditation practice, but there's a core practice which is the basis of our work. I've been doing this work since 1970, where as a young medical anthropologist in a medical system, University of Miami School of Medicine, I saw that the most marginalized population happened to be dying people. Very interesting. So the absence of healthcare professionals here speaks, volumes to me. And I began my own Buddhist practice in 1965 as a civil rights worker and anti-war person. Back in the 1960s, some of us were in that situation. And I never really thought that these worlds would come together, but they did, after a while. And really, I looked, as an anthropologist, into many spiritual traditions for technologies that would make it possible for me to be more present for people who were suffering deeply, and also people who were suffering from life-threatening illnesses. And again, I wasn't, as a Buddhist, I didn't think of Buddhism as the place that would give me what I have eventually received. But as I looked into Christianity and Hinduism, into the Muslim faith, shamanism, and many other faiths, including Buddhism, Buddhism had an extraordinary amount to offer. If one investigated all three schools of Buddhism, from the early teachings of the Buddha through Mahayana up into the Vajrayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana teachings, many meditational strategies that make it possible to work with issues around dying, suffering, and death. In fact, I think everything Buddhist, even if you're Zen and not so much into the early teachings or into early Buddhism, everything Buddhist refers back to just what is death, what is life, what is death, what is life. But what was so important to me beside the philosophy were the actual technologies. And just starting with what we're going to do tonight, the most simple, basic practice, really the most fundamental, which is how to be fully present. How to develop a mind that's very concentrated, that's confident and vulnerable, that's equanimous and compassionate, that's stable and open. All qualities that are essential in being in the presence of suffering, including our own. So if we look at the basic meditation posture, and there's a great emphasis of this in Zen meditation, of the actual posture, being grounded is important. I remember I worked with this mythologist many years ago, Joseph Campbell. I used to be this really wild thing. And I came into Joe's place one day where he was working on this book, and I was his research assistant. And he said to me, you should put pennies in your shoes. I thought it was very funny. I really didn't understand what he meant for a long time. Well, he meant I wasn't grounded at all. And I was just like this. To do this work requires not just pennies, you need really lead in your shoes, you need earth in your shoes, you need rocks in your shoes. So when you sit, you need to sit, whether you're sitting in a chair or sitting on a cushion, you need to have a basis of a really strong foundation, just like a rock. So I don't really care what you do with your legs. That's really a personal decision. But I want your legs comfortable, actually. I want your body comfortable. This is not about developing an aversion to meditation practice by, you know, sustaining a posture which creates pain for you. It's actually putting the body into a position that can sustain the mind, your presence in the mind. You'll have enough pain in the course of your life. You don't have to make more. So I'll just give you a few hints. In a way, the ideal posture is the full lotus. But you can only do that if you've been in a sort of situation where your mother, in a sense, has rubbed your little legs with oil and the square, you know, teeny square in Kathmandu as you're sitting in the sun, and you get all this nice little flexible joints. So if you can't do the full lotus, don't bother. For most of us, it's just too late. It was too late by the time we hit adolescence. I do really encourage yoga, though, for opening up your joints, and long and strong for making your body able to sustain you better. The half lotus also is wonderful. Both the full and the half lotus sustain a much stronger back. You can really feel the difference if you sit in the half lotus, which I don't do anymore. My joints don't like it. But it's just, you sit up with more strength. And I need the strength from you. It's body commitment. This is an embodied practice. I like the Burmese. The legs folded in front of each other like this. And one of the good things about this posture is that many of us can sustain it. But if your legs are up in the air, if your pants are too tight, if you're not stretched out here, it's really not very sustainable. So you can try the horse, which is putting the meditation cushion between your legs and getting a meditation bench. Again, you want strength and presence in your practice. This is not you're lumping down into some kind of undifferentiated state. You want to be grounded and able to sustain your presence. Do you get this feeling? This is facing life and death. So when we come into the meditation hall, the first thing I would like you to do really is to settle your posture. That is to find a posture, a way of sitting that works for you. And tomorrow morning I'm going to walk quietly, and if you have any questions just about the technique of the posture, you know, just make a little bow. That's only to tell me I need a little help. Okay. And I'll stop and then see if we can find a way for your body to sit strongly. The posture is a reflection of your mind, and the posture resonates or tunes the mind. So, like for example, being in a chair is wonderful, and it's good to have your feet flat on the floor, your legs not crossed. You don't have to do it now, but anyway. And what's really nice, if you're able to, is actually when you do meditation, to come to the edge of your chair so that you're not leaning back. You know, you're developing embodiment and strength in your posture. Some people have physical problems, and so it's fine for them not to do this. So, you know, no demerits, but good guidelines. So try, you know, in the morning when we have this 45-minute period of just sitting, if you're in a chair and if it's appropriate for you to get a little more physically engaged, if it's appropriate. If not, that's fine. The back. The image of the back. Strong back. You want the spine vertical. You want volume in the torso. You want space in the torso. You don't want to be collapsed over. it really impedes the breath and you're collapsed over your heart. You're sort of this kind of thing. And in Zen, you know, we have a lift in the chest so that you have this sense of space in the whole torso. It's very important because it makes it possible actually to meditate for quite long periods. Once the muscles in the torso are strong enough so that you have much less pain in the back from sitting. But strong back, the back is not stiff, it's flexible, it's alive, it's conductive. You don't want to be a stiff, you know, a stuffed shirt, brittle in the back. You want the spine alive, you want the mind alive, you want the mind vertical, and yet conductive. So strong back means you have that kind of flexibility in the spine. The wind comes, the grass bends down. Strong back, that's our equanimity, our capacity to uphold ourselves in the midst of any conditions. The front of the body is open and is soft. Soft front, this is the capacity of compassion or inclusiveness. So you'll hear me say every so often, strong back, soft front. Or find your seat. And strong back, soft front. Stability, equanimity, compassion. And the interdependence of equanimity and compassion. Because compassion without equanimity cannot sustain. I mean, really, the heart will just break. But equanimity without compassion won't sustain either. So you come into the sensibility of strong back, soft front, or equanimity and compassion, you realize actually it's two sides of the same coin. That equanimity is, if you will, the back of compassion. And compassion is the front of equanimity. And mostly, most of us have a strong front and a strong back. You know, we're very defended. And you could see it in people's eyes. You know, they just, it's just this unwillingness to be transparent because they feel so inadequate, so hurt. So you see people whose backs are really not strong, the proverbial back, and the front is very defended. This won't work. This is an unsustainable life. You have to get things right by, if you know what I mean. Find, have the strength in the right place and the openness in the right place. So this practice is about that. The shoulders are relaxed. The hands really change the mind in an interesting way. You know, and by the way, relaxing the shoulders is rather important. A lot of us carry our office, our duties, our responsibilities here. So, you know, we want the shoulders soft, the chest lifted. The hands are actually, they do make a difference in how the mind works. If, as in often in Vipassana centers, people put their hands on their knees. This is a very interesting way to meditate. It's much more about shared consciousness, even with the eyes closed. And so if you tend to be dispersive, drifty or dreamy, or scattered, it's very helpful to actually gather the mind and do this cosmic mudra, this mudra here, bringing the hands together, gathering them in front of the belly. The right hand is supporting the fingers of the left. The thumbs are barely touching. You gather the mind, plant it in the spine. Get very focused. Because what I want us to do in the early morning meditation is basically samatha practice. and is to really bring our attention to one object and to let that object, for most of us, hopefully it will be the breath. Very important, our life hangs by it. It's a very good object of concentration, but pain is also not so bad either. So try the cosmic mudra, this mudra. It gives a lot of strength to our presence. Okay. The windows in the neck are open, so this is not the computer posture. I'm on the computer quite a bit because I write, so I know this posture. No. Open the windows in the back of the neck. The chest is lifted, chin slightly tucked in. The countenance is relaxed. Really relax the face. Let the personality drop off. It's fascinating. If you have the opportunity to sit with someone who's died and there their corpse is, often the face relaxes into a smile. Like at last, this kind of smile emerges. So, you know, at first you feel sort of depressed because you're letting the personality go. But it's fine, let it go. Just do the practice and let the serenity arise from within. Don't feel that you have to project happiness. Let the happiness arise naturally. So soften the jaw, the teeth are barely touching. The tongue is resting on the hard palate behind the teeth, very gently. The lips are barely touching. The jaw is very soft. The tissue around the eyes and the eyeballs themselves are very soft. The whole feeling is a softness. And yet there's a little thread that's giving you strength and volume. The crown is pressing into the heavens. The lower part of the body is rooted into the earth. So that's the phase one of settling the posture. And after a while, it just does itself. The posture does itself. But just even though some of your old hands have been practicing a long time, if you would, even the old timers of you, just allow a few beats to recall the elements of the posture, most specifically stability, equanimity, compassion, and then presence. These four functions: stability, equanimity, compassion, presence. The second thing that I would like you to do then when the posture is settled is what's called cultivating bodhicitta. To recognize that you're not here on just a self-improvement program. And this is a Mahayana perspective that we work with. It is actually using altruism as a way to expand our practice into depth and meaning so that compassion is, and altruism are the basis of our practice. So if we're sitting just for our own liberation, then from the Mahayana perspective, that's not quite enough. I mean, wonderful. I would love it if somebody immediately became liberated. I'm sure you would love it too if that person happened to be you, but the best thing really is to bring yourself from the perspective of a Mahayana practitioner. I'm a very poor practitioner, but to use your practice as a way to actually cultivate this sense that it's not just me, just my little local self. that actually I'm practicing here out of the longing that all beings can be free from suffering. And this is at one, you know, one, it's a strategy. It's a very wonderful strategy to get you off your sort of self-centeredness. You know, and then of course at the end of a Mahayana practice period, you always dedicate the merit, may the merit of this practice penetrate into each thing in all realms and benefit all beings. That's a way to say, I'm not going to bank the goodness of this practice. You know, I want to really turn it around and to give whatever good that has arisen away to others. So this is a wonderful strategy. But actually, it gives a quality of meaning in your practice. It opens your practice up into a kind of inclusivity. And it is a beautiful path for realizing your interconnectedness in the absence of a separate self-identity. So I'm going to ask you, you know, when you settle your posture, to actually take a few minutes and do what's called cultivating bodhicitta. But in your situation, I'm going to ask you, for the purpose of this retreat, to actually bring to mind someone whom you know who is suffering, really suffering. Someone perhaps who's close to death. And by the way, it doesn't even have to be a person. It can be a pet. I know people go, oh, really? But, I mean, our relationships with our pets are often more undefended and loving than they are with the people we're married to. I mean, it's really true. I had tea yesterday in this tea house. And the way this guy loved his dog, the tea man, you know, the clotted cream thing I was exposed to yesterday. Just, you know, talk about an easy death. God, what are those years about all my arteries to sustain? But here this guy, you know, was with his dog, and I mean his thing was his dog. And it was just amazing. This dog wandered around this tea house, and everybody was rubbing this dog's head, and the dog was just, you know, receiving a huge amount of love. And I realized, you know, this dog was really a magnet for something, you know, for all of us. I started petting the dog too. And I realized I would hate to see anything happen to this dog. You know, just like, oh. Then the owner, the tea owner, told me the dog had actually been stolen that week. And they'd offered a reward, they'd gotten the dog back. But, you know, he talked about just being crazy. You know, well, brokenhearted because his dog was gone. So I actually think that pets are often where we hold a tremendous amount of unexpressed grief. It's sort of embarrassing to have that kind of sense. Do you sleep with your dog? He said, yes. So do I. I'm a nun. I sleep with my dog. So. So it's okay if you bring a pet into your meditation, okay? You can be a pet or a person, and your person can be alive or dead. I really want you to cultivate a tender heart. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, like, you know, Henry, your little boy was sick, so bring your little boy into your meditation. You see how vulnerable he is. He's losing weight, and how you felt, and what you wish for him. You know, bring a being in, so that you're activated. You know, you're not just sort of sitting on your cushion for yourself. And then when you have some sense of compassion and kindness present, through an intimate and actual relationship, a real thing, then turn to your practice. And we'll actually be doing a number of different practices through the retreat, but everything is based on, it's very simple, it's all samatha. But it just gets fancier. Mm-hmm. Right. And for the purpose of this retreat, I'm going to ask you to please, unless you have a special reason, to bring your attention gently to your breath. So after your heart is present, bodhicitta is cultivated, kind of nectar in the heart, then let your attention be present in the moment. And give your attention in this practice to your exhalation. Some of you I know pay attention to the inhalation, to the sensations, the nose or something. But actually, what I would like us to do is to realize the value of a certain quality of gentle and open attention on the out-breath. Because we want the out-breath actually to have a kind of power of letting go. That is sort of how it happens. I mean, when the body doesn't meet the breath anymore, you're dead. And those of us who've attended a number of deaths know how interesting it is to see the out-breath running out of the body, just threading out. And that's it.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.